Well, you can ask that question and just forget about the in Vietnam, because mm-hmm. this would be true of characteristics of leadership are true no matter where or what situation. First and foremost thing that strikes any enlisted man about the caliber of an officer, the one characteristic that is really important, is the officer's attitude toward his troops insofar as their welfare is concerned. When you find an officer that really exhibits interest in the welfare of his troops, as far as the conditions of their living, what kind of food they're being fed, their health, safety, comfort. Then you find that there's a reciprocity of the feeling from the junior man to the officer. He might be lousy. He might be a terrible communicator, or flies his aircraft into the side of mountains, or can't find his rear end in the fog. But if this guy, as far as leadership ability is concerned, is really concerned about the welfare of his troops, looks out for the troops, then you'll find a lot of loyalty given up. You know, there's that loyalty down business, or loyalty up business, and that comes from loyalty down. And any good leader, you know, that's one of the basic properties of leadership that's taught to junior officers when they go through basic school or go through platoon leaders class or whatnot. Look out for the troops and they'll look out for you.
So then there weren't any specific characteristics or instances in Vietnam that would make an officer different than, say, back in the States?
Oh, no. Of course, you know, in a combat situation or in a situation where you're getting shot at or there's some element of danger, the relationship is sharpened considerably, because what an officer does can have a direct relationship on your well-being. You know, whether you get your ass shot off, or whether or not you get fed, or whether you get mail on time. And those things are important. Whether where you're living is adequate or inadequate.
I wanted to ask you about living conditions too. You just sort of touched on it. What were the differences, say, between the enlisted man and the officer's quarters?
Well, considerable. Although now in the organization I was in, we were living in barracks. We were living in Southeast Asia type of barracks, a standard type of construction. They're made out of plywood and screens to keep the mosquitoes out. Of course, on top of Monkey Mountain, we lived in it. You live in practically up to your eyebrows in water all the time. It's rain and fog and just a lot of clouds. You're living right in the clouds. So living there was not, although we were in garrison in effect, it was not very comfortable living because things were so wet. Strangely enough, one of the most sought after comforts at Monkey Mountain was an electric blanket. The reason being, not because you needed it for warmth, although it got damn chilly up there, you had an electric blanket that kept your bunk dry.
Uh-huh.
If you've ever crawled between wet sheets or under a wet blanket, oh, God almighty, that's just terrible. You can't get warm. It's just impossible to be comfortable trying to sleep wet. And as a result, electric blankets are just marvelous for that. We had unlimited power up there. We had 650 kW generators ran 24 hours a day because of all our electronics equipment. Had to keep the perimeter lights on and all that kind of business. So we had unlimited access to electrical power. And I can't think of anybody over there who didn't have an electric blanket. Everybody sent home for them or bought them from the exchange or when they went on R&R or had a buddy bring it back from Hong Kong or Tokyo or wherever they went on R&R, bring back a double handful of electric blankets.
Were any of the troops that were on Monkey Mountain stationed like in combat areas and then sent back?
Yes. We had a infantry security unit there that was made up of people who had oh, had three Purple Hearts, been wounded two times or three times, I can't remember which. Some who have medical problems, and by medical problems, I, you know, might have mental problems, disciplinary problems. We had some people that came out of the brig that were sent up to our organization. So we had some pretty tough young kids up there that kind of been through it.
The reason I asked was because I was wondering if they ever spoke of living conditions in a combat area. I know they must have been very different than the ones you had on Monkey Mountain.
Well, Vietnam was a rather strange war in that that the Marine Corps operated out of fixed bases, out of these isolated perimeters, cantonments, enclaves, where they'd have a strong point, a fire base. You know, that was the usual term that was used. There'd be a fire base set up, and in the larger fire bases, there would be helicopter pads, possibly even an airstrip. There'd be an artillery unit. This whole thing would be usually be on a piece of high ground, and the whole thing would be surrounded by fixed barbed wire, by a very complex series of bunkers, caves, trenches, fighting positions, and something I had never seen before or even dreamed of. The whole damn thing would be lit up.
Why is that?
They'd light it at night because of the... they inherited this concept from the French. The French are great for this business. They form a defense perimeter and reinforce it, and then light it up using perimeter lights, tremendous floodlights, shining out so that you light up the area around you. You clear all the jungle. You clear everything off. You mine it. And put up wire and all that business. And this way, since the concept is that since they know where you are anyway, they're going to know where you are, you might as well make it just as tough for them as you can.
So then the lights more or less help you than they help them.
That's the concept. Now, I don't buy that. I don't buy the operating out of a fixed perimeter, out of these fire bases. That's not the way I was trained. That's not the way I would operate if I had my choice. But that's the way we operated there, because that's the way the Army operated, and the Marine Corps had to operate the way the Army does. So as a result, the operations, combat operations, at the infantry level, were really a series of armed patrols, combat patrols, and this would vary in strength, say, from a four-man fire team up to a battalion-sized raid, where you go out in full strength, with a platoon of tanks, with artillery support, with air cover, the whole business. But the way the operations ran, it was really strange. A really long-range, large-scale operation would probably not run more than 48 hours. You go out, you do your bit, you go out and blow somebody away, or you go out and set up an ambush, you go out on an in-strength patrol simply to stir up the countryside, but then you return back to your fire base. So living, even out in a combat situation, you're living within the fire base. You're living in a fixed structure. You might be living in a hooch. You might be living in a nice, comfortable bunker, which is you spend all your spare time fixing up. You have all the comforts at home in a nice big bunker. And the only time you really get out and live like a pig is when you're on patrol. And then, you're sleeping on an air mattress and rolled up in a poncho and eating sea rations. But never for very prolonged period of time.
Did the enlistees complain bitterly about the differences in living conditions? I mean, like between enlisted men and officers?
that's traditional. That's not peculiar to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The commanding general always has a beautiful quarters. The colonel has slightly less grand, and right on down. And the junior trooper always feels that, they're dumping crap on his head because Which is true. RHIP rank has its privileges. That's part of the military system. It always has been. It always will be. The Vietnam War didn't have a damn thing to do with that system. You know. And I'm sure that no matter who you talk to, he always, whether he's a private or a colonel or a general, you know, he feels that somebody else has it better than he has. You know, I'm sure the corps commander felt that Westmoreland was really living pretty good down there in Saigon.
I bet.
So, you know, that's a universal bitch. That always has been.
Do you think that all these different types of people that were sent to Monkey Mountain, like men who had seen combat, added additional tension? Like you said, there were some cases, or mental cases, health cases.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that, say, some of these soldiers that came in with mental cases added tension?
Some of these Marines?
Yeah.
I'm going to quit talking to you. You don't remember that?
Well, I know they're Marines.
Yeah, okay. Well, yes, there was some the inevitable contempt that some tough young Marine who feels that he has been the only one that's really experienced the war. You know, he's been out there eyeball with those slow pits. That inevitable contempt that he feels for some guy that's been sitting on his nuff up on top of a rocket safe Monkey Mountain with a nice club to go to every night. You know. But these attitudes are always exaggerated. And, within any organization, any military organization, there's a feeling of esprit with your fellow sufferers or your buddies. Motor transport is always feels that, you know, they're the workhorses. Communicators always feel that they're a little bit above it all. You know, they're the sophisticates of the organization. And the cooks and bakers always feel that they're getting crapped on. Yeah, you know, that's just standard. And in a situation like we had at Monkey Mountain, there was some tension in the security platoon. They tended to keep to themselves. They had their own hooches. Pretty good bunch of kids. When I was acting as sergeant major, I kind of took them under my wing. And of course, I Max IV was an air wing unit, and I'm an ex-grunt. The first 13 years I spent in the Marine Corps was as a grunt, so I tend to identify with those youngsters quite a bit. So I got along with them well. Pretty good bunch of kids.
Well, do you think they felt really alienated?
Well, I don't think they felt alienated. They felt humiliated being associated with an air wing unit. That's built into a grunt, you know. They learned that in boot camp.
Let's see, I wanted to ask you about how not only you, but the people that you were around, the people you lived with, what your views were of men that went AWOL or the draft dodgers.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well,
my attitude then?
Yes, while you were there, what was your attitude toward men that went AWOL? Say, men that went on R&R and that just didn't come back.
Well, I felt contempt. You know, you have to remember now, I spent 26 years in the Marine Corps. And so any kid that stepped outside the system, you know, as far as I was concerned, deserved to have his ass kicked up around his ears. I certainly, we didn't have much problems like that. We had no problems like that at all in the organization that I was in. There was some problems down in Da Nang, but I really don't think that the AWOL problem was a very big one with the Marine Corps. I don't remember any serious problems. I don't remember hearing any of my friends, you know, discussing this as a serious problem.
Well, what about the draft dodgers? I know that if I had been in Vietnam and I knew of all these people that were going to Canada and going to Europe, I think I'd be pretty mad.
Well, of course. Of course. I think everybody felt the same way, including some of these youngsters that you talk to now. who have been politicized, as I have myself, you know, in my university career. But I think any man that's been in uniform is contemptuous, really contemptuous of a draft dodger. You may find now some of these Vietnamese veterans against the war type, you know, the VBAWs, who express sympathy for the youngsters that went to Canada. But I think that's an afterthought. I don't think they felt that sympathy when they were in Vietnam in uniform. Felt no sympathy at all. I just can't imagine any uniformed man saying, oh, yeah, sure. They might say, well, I wish the hell I'd done that, or I'd had enough damn sense to do it, or I wish I'd had the nerve to do it. But those sentiments would be suspect, I think, as far as I'm concerned.
When we were talking about the drugs, you mentioned that there were very few civilians around. What were the jobs that the Vietnamese people had on the bases?
Well, on Monkey Mountain, we had a barber. We had a Vietnamese barber. We had waitresses in the clubs. And we had a laundry that was run by the Air Force. See, the United States Air Force had the security responsibility for Monkey Mountain, although they didn't do a damn thing about it, but they had the responsibility. We provided our own security. But they controlled the services, like, you know, the contact with Vietnamese laundries, and as far as getting hostesses up there for parties and things like that. We didn't subscribe to that program, but the Air Force had a site about 4 or 5 miles away from us, and they had organized these kind of things. You know, they had quite a few civilians. We have very limited. Occasionally, a garbage contractor came up and worked over our dump. Our dump was outside the perimeter, however.
Did you work with any civilians?
Not Vietnamese. I had contact with them at the club. We had I can't remember her name now. She's really a really nice gal, married to a Vietnamese Air Force lieutenant who had been killed, and she had a couple of kids she was trying to raise and support. She made a hell of a living up there. She was managed our club, managed the waitresses. And we just tipped the hell out of her. She made a pretty good living out of
it. I can imagine.
She was my primary contact.
Those guys.
She spoke pretty good English and was very friendly.
Well, can you give me what your overall view is of the Vietnamese people? Not necessarily the civilians that come to camp, but the civilians, like, in their villages.
Well, I had considerable contact with Vietnamese civilians in Da Nang. I went down in Da Nang quite often due to the nature of my job. I had to go down to wing headquarters and go down to the Corps headquarters quite often. So I observed them, and I had considerable contact with Vietnamese and with members of the Vietnamese Armed Forces, you know, like my opposite numbers and communications units. And, I view the Vietnamese against a background of considerable experience in the Orient. I spent a lot of time in the Orient. I spent time in China and Japan and the Philippines, and I've done duty in in Thailand. I've been on quite a few of the islands. I spent a lot of time in Hawaii, where you see all of the Oriental, all hodgepodge together, you know, Pakis and the Japanese and so on. And I think the Vietnamese, this is my own personal opinion, I think the Vietnamese are the least attractive of the Orientals, of the ethnic Oriental groups. And I mean this both in a physical sense. They're not very good looking people. They're small and they tend to be darker, and they're not well formed. physically. You know what I mean?
They're small in structure.
They're small in structure, and they tend to be, they have physical characteristics that simply don't appeal to me. I don't know, small boned, and they have the rather flat-nosed, but bad teeth. Of course, that has to do with the lousy water and the lousy medical attention and so on and so on, and their diet. And there are still Vietnamese that chew betel nut, you know, one of the least attractive habits. You know, can you imagine a woman chewing tobacco, and teeth black, you know, and terrible. Makes their tongue red and their teeth black. It just looks like hell. And the Vietnamese simply, they don't, because of their diet and the way they live, they don't age very gracefully. By the time a woman is 40, she's an old hag. Just a drone. And, of course, their literacy rate is very bad. They're just an unattractive people. Of all the places I can think of in the Orient, if I were going back to live in the Orient, of all the places I can think of, Vietnam would be absolutely the last that I would consider going to. Absolutely the last. God, I'd rather go down and live in Borneo amidst them with a damned headhunters than live comfortably in Saigon with Vietnamese.
Do you portray their physical appearance as a reason that there just weren't very many enlisted men marrying Vietnamese girls?
Well, that undoubtedly is one of the reasons. The fact that there was the R&R device, which relieved the sexual frustrations that are inevitable with any young guy. You know.
Any guy.
Any guy. Well, that's true, any guy. But specifically, there was the R&R situation. Where people, you know, youngsters got a chance to go to Hong Kong or go to Taiwan or go to Bangkok or go down to the Philippines or the ultimate, go to Australia. I think that relieved a lot of that tension. And the physical unattractiveness, although I've seen some beautiful Vietnamese girls, but not too many.
Did you take an R&R?
Oh, yeah.
Where did you go?
Met my wife twice in Hawaii.
Did
First time she brought the kids, the second time just the two of us.
That's the best way to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Oh, we had a great time.
Can you tell me, is having an R&R, I know it relieved a lot of the sexual tensions for most of the guys, but did it make it harder to go back, or was it something to look forward to? Or
well,
you were just living
yeah.
for the R&R?
Yeah, R&R, your whole schedule, your whole, everything zoomed in on that R&R. You know, time passed very slowly there. And waiting for that R&R to roll around, God almighty, it just seemed like it would never come. And of course, when you have to fly, the whole situation is just unbelievable. You haven't been through it. You go down to a center and usually get hung up there a couple of days waiting for transportation. You finally get on that damn plane. You fly. Nothing more boring than flying on a jet for 12, 14 hours. You finally get there, and my God, the change is so just fantastic. The difference between going from Da Nang, say, to going to Melbourne, or go to Honolulu, or go to Tokyo, or to Bangkok, and it's just whirlwind, frantic. Booze and women and good food and spending money like drunken sailors and just, you know. And wango, it's all over in 4.5 or 5 days. It's all over, and you get back on an aircraft and you go back to that unbelievable garbage pit. You step off the plane in Vietnam, and it's like getting slapped in the face with a dead fish. It's just such a terrible letdown. So there was an either-or situation about R&R. It's so fantastic to look forward to and to do, but a tremendous letdown to come back to and face another 3 or 4 months, you know, or happy years.
Did Did you have any press problems, like once you left Vietnam and went on your R&R? I wanted to, what I'm trying to get at is, what were press relations like with the Marines or with any service?
Well, we were cautioned not to talk to the press.
Why is that?
Well, the press had really, you know, they had reported things very factually about the Vietnamese War, which made the military madder than hell. There are a lot of things you do that you simply don't want people to know about. And press is very unsympathetic about the Vietnamese War. And as a result, the military hierarchy simply did not want to expose themselves to any of that kind of, you know, what they consider propaganda. So we were cautioned not to talk about, you know, what was going on in Vietnam. But any request for interviews had to be cleared through proper authorities. And they were discouraged. The Marine Corps wanted any contact with the press to be handled strictly through a public relations officer. You know, where it could be controlled, and where the line could be the official line, and, you know, properly censored, and so on and so forth.
Were there press problems in Vietnam itself?
Well, I have no personal experience with that. We used to see a few newspaper men come up to Monkey Mountain, because we had a fantastic club and the greatest view in the world. You could sit on our veranda and drink champagne and watch the war go by. Really great. So we had a lot of visitors up there. Fantastic amount of commissioned officers came up there just to see the view, to look at how the other half were living the war, you know. So we saw some newspaper men, but they were up there. They weren't up there looking for a story. They were up there just having a ball, you know. Up there to have a drink, take a look at view.
After your tour of duty was over in Vietnam and you were back, what was your transition to civilian life like?
Well, I think I was rather unusual in that respect. I came back and retired.
So you got a double whammo.
Not really. Not really. The transition was painless. I had to put in my letter to retire before I left Vietnam. I'd made up my mind I wanted to do that. You know, I own a home in San Diego. I'm settled here. My family lived here. I was processed for 30 days right here at Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. And by processing, that means that it took them 30 days to score my papers away. And I checked in once a week. First couple of weeks, I went down there. And the last couple of weeks, I just called in. So I was on leave, really, for 30 days. And during that leave, I went down to register to City College, took all the tests, got ready to go to school, played a lot of golf, got reacquainted with my wife and kids. And on a Friday afternoon, at the end of July 1970, I went to, or August 1970, I can't even remember now, August, I guess it was, end of August. On Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock, I got in the uniform for the first day in 30 days. A month and went down there and took part of a retirement parade. There were seven others who retired the same time I did. Shook hands with the commanding general and he gave me my orders to the Fleet Marine Corps Reserve. Got back in my car and drove out the gate and kissed it goodbye. And it's been that easy for me, really.
It was that easy to leave behind after what, 26 years?
I go back down to Marine Corps Recruit Depot once a month to get a haircut, whether I need it or not.
So you didn't leave it all.
I haven't shined my shoes since I retired. I haven't worn a tie. It's a
Would you say that you're glad to have had the Vietnam experience?
Yes. I certainly wouldn't want to repeat it.
But you wouldn't want to forget it?
Well, I don't think it's all that really dramatic, but I wouldn't want to forget it. Of course, it's something that you don't forget. It's a year out of my life. That's 1/47th of my life. That's blown away forever, you know. It was a wasted year. I don't feel I accomplished a damn thing except by my presence perhaps contributed to the political chaos that was going on then and it's still going on, you know. But I don't think I would have been content in my military career had I not gone. At the time I went, I felt that it was something I had to do. Of course, once I got there, it was all a bag of worms. No, I don't regret it. You know, it's part of my background.
I really appreciate the interview.